So this is my fourth and last lecture on economic anthropology. We've been through 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, reduction, stratification, and exchange last week, and we're now on to the 21st century and consumption. I gave you the fantasy that we would be born in Sainsbury's and live our lives in Tesco's and die in one of those two superstores, Walmart perhaps. So we now all live in a consumer world, and anthropologists are interested in this. In this lecture, I'm only going to be able to touch on a few of the things that interest me, but I'm going to point you in directions where, if what I say does interest you, there are further resources on my website and elsewhere for you to pursue. So I'm going to start with money. What is money? Well, money is a medium which has several functions. Our money, that is general purpose money, anthropologists distinguish between special purpose and general purpose. Our money, which is general purpose money, has three or four main functions. One is it's divisible, it is hopefully portable. I mentioned Tibetan tea money, and although you can carry a certain amount of this around, your pockets would get rather cluttered if you carried too many tea blocks around in your pocket. So our money is portable and fungible. That's F-U-N-G-I-B-L-E. Well, I wasn't familiar with it before I gave these lectures, but it basically means to supply the office of. That means you can exchange it. So you can exchange a sack of grain and a pile of coins because they are fungible, they can be exchanged. And its other function, of course, is as a store of value. That's general purpose money. Most societies have some kind of money. A famous example is in Russell Island, who have a sophisticated shell currency in which shells had numbers, with the higher number having the greater value. But you can't convert them. You can't convert a large, if you've got 20 very small shells and you want one big shell, you can't go to someone with a big shell and swap it. It isn't exchangeable. And so it's lacking one of the main features of money, that you can exchange low denominations for high denominations. Another famous study of special purpose money is by Bohannon on the Nigerian TIV in later colonial times. The TIV used iron bars to allow the exchange of a range of luxury goods. So you could exchange tobacco, cattle and slaves for iron bars. However, it was not considered appropriate to use this currency either for the purchase of subsistence goods, given by grain and things like that with iron bars, or for the acquisition of wives. So there are spheres of exchange, as anthropologists say, which means that certain types of money can be used for certain sorts of things. That's just what money is, and the differences between types of money. The effects of money interests me a lot, and they affect you deeply. Now I'll just give you one or two thoughts from, this is actually taken from my letter to my granddaughter about what money does to you, letters to Lily. Money stands for a relation of power over others. It's like oil in a machine, for it allows the parts to function without grinding against each other. It's a translation device, a leveller. It makes objects in different spheres exchangeable. This is basically part one, economic anthropology. It allows us to create one commodity and then to exchange it for another. And yet, even in our civilization, as I pointed out last time, money is restricted in its use. There are certain parts of our lives where we put up a sign saying, no money here. Certain beautiful things are beyond the reach of money. The vases in the Fitzwilliam Museum, which someone fell into a couple of days ago and smashed some priceless vases, they're really beyond price. I was talking to one of the syndics of the Fitzwilliam yesterday, and he said, well, you can't insure such vases, they're too valuable, and there's nothing really you can do about it. He mentioned a Hieronymus Bosch that he'd curated in an American gallery, and it was worth minimally $280 million, but it's actually priceless. So certain, if you go into King's and ask if you could buy that Rubens there, they'll say no, you know, we can't sell it, it's beyond price. It is actually got a price, but it, you know, they won't sell it, nor will they sell bits of the chapel or the grass and so on. There are lots of things. You're not supposed to be able to buy your way into Cambridge University. How many of you bought your way into Cambridge University? Many of you will admit you bought your way into Cambridge University. It's meant to be not buyable. Love is not meant to be buyable. Certain beautiful national parks, all sorts of things are not for sale. That's an odd feature of our life, that we make areas where money can move and areas where it can't. Yet in much of our life, money holds us to ransom. It slips through our hands in a slithery way. The more we have, the more we seem to need. You're always reading articles of people who say, my joint income, there was one on Sunday, my joint income is only £80,000 a year, if I can't manage all that. Of course, if you send your children to private schools, etc., etc., you probably can't. So whatever you have, you always need more. It's like the fairy story, a pot of gold, which when you have it, it turns to dust. Money turns to dust in our hands and always requires us to need more and more and more. This is the paradox which is famously put forward in Salim's Original Affluent Society, one of the great articles in anthropology and philosophy, really, in his Stone Age Economics. The paradox that in our society we consider ourselves affluent, but we're not. We're impoverished because the laws of the market constantly raise the threshold above what we can attain. We are constantly trying to strive for more than we have. Whatever the amount of money we have, we just need that little bit more. Whereas very simple societies, as he points out, hunters and gatherers, they don't need anything. There's no market, there's no desires really beyond what they have. So they are the original affluent society. They are the Zen solution. They have more than they need. They gamble, they give away. They're in a surplus situation. So our society is impoverished. And many simpler societies are actually affluent in the sense of having more than you need. And that results in happiness. Because we suffer from the well-known revolution of rising expectations. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, 3 years ago, when I went to China, I had lunch with one of the local officials, and he said, when I was a boy in China 20 years ago, I once went to see my cousins in the town, and we had dumplings for breakfast. We had dumplings every breakfast for a week. I thought, this is heaven. If I could ever be in a world where I could have dumplings every morning for breakfast, I would never want more of life. He said, now, my daughter, of course, gets dumplings every day. She wants to do a PhD at Harvard University. I can't afford to give her that. It just rises very, very fast, and this is happening throughout our lives and many parts of the world. The tragedy, as Salins puts it, is that every time we make a choice, we cut off other options. The famous example, which is not sure he gives it, but all of us have experienced, is you go to a good restaurant with your friends for a meal. The menu comes along and you think, oh God, there's everything here I want. Which shall I have? And then you choose something or other. And all the other things remain untasted and desires unfulfilled and so on. So you're always negating and not choosing things. So there's always a corner of your mind feeling slightly frustrated that you can only have certain things and not other things. And yet our economy and our culture, and this is the way, the trick that capitalism plays on us, exhorts us to try and earn more, to try and consume more, to spend, get more and more money. Now, if you stand back from the situation, and you consult the greatest of all economists, Adam Smith, he said that what you've got to do if you want happiness, and he was a moral philosopher, is not to worry so much about how much you earn, but how much you spend. But the way to save, the way to be happy, and of course you have to remember his Calvinist background, and he's a Scotsman and the rest of it. But basically, if you're finding you haven't got enough, don't spend all your time fretting about how you can earn more, but think a bit about how you could spend a little less, and then you will bring your ends and means into line, because it's that bringing of the ends and the means together that is really crucial. The famous account of it, which some of you may know, of course, is from David Copperfield by Charles Dickens. Mr. Micawber, how many of you know Mr. Micawber's advice? Okay, Mr. Micawber's advice is this: engrave it on your heart. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, 19 and sixpence. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, 0 and 6. Result, misery. He didn't take his own advice, of course, but he knew what to say. So if you overspend just a little all the time. And yet, I'm not saying that money isn't important, and I wanted to just end with a joke from Woody Allen, who some of you may know. He observed, "Money is better than poverty, if only for financial reasons." Okay. Last quote I gave my granddaughter from the great philosopher Francis Bacon. He said, money is like manure, not good unless it be spread. So, there's a few bits of worldly advice. So let's now move on to consumption. Consumption, I mentioned, we're all caught in a consumer society and the world is full of consumption. It's really, in many ways, more important than anything. It's more important than politics, it's more important than religion in many societies. Daniel Bell, the sociologist, says the cultural transformation of modern society is due singularly to the rise of mass consumption. And John Berger, in his book Ways of Seeing, writes, publicity throws consumption into a substitute for democracy. The choice of what one eats or wears or drives takes the place of significant political change. Our masters know that. They know that if they can keep us happy consuming, then they don't have to worry too much about the political odds and ends. Anthropologists have written and sociologists quite a bit now about consumption, and there were two readings on the reading list by Danny Miller and others. A couple of their theories that might interest you. One is the general observation, which actually stems from Max Weber, that our society is now stratified not by class, not by, which means the relations to the means of production and the acquisition of goods, but by status groups, in Weber's terms. And a status group is controlling not the relations of production, but the ways in which you consume goods. So a status group expresses itself, for instance, by what it wears, what it eats, and so on. In some funny ways, as I was reading through this morning and thinking about China, which interests me, in a way China has moved from a supposed communist classless society to a status group society. Everything in China, if you've, any of you have been there, is really now about consumption. It's not about the relations of production, which anyway were abolished with private property, but it's all about how much you earn and consume. So it's jumped a stage, so to speak. And you can see, in fact, the Chinese case is rather interesting because it moved from status group to status group with an intervening phase of communism. Traditional China was very much a high consumption society in the court of the Mandarins. Then you had the Cultural Revolution, which led to radical egalitarianism. Mao understood quite well that in order to abolish class, you have to abolish the symbols of class. So everyone wore those famous blue Mao suits, everyone ate the same food, they went to the same sort of schools, the intellectuals were sent out into the countryside, everything was leveled, everyone was identical. They looked identical, they consumed identically, everything was abolished. And now it's moved back to a mass consumption, conspicuous consumption society on a huge scale because it's growing so fast everywhere. The other theory that I draw your attention to, which is talked about in Chris Hand's book that's on the reading list, stems from the famous work of Mary Douglas and others, Aaron Isherwood, on the world of goods, where they distinguish between three consumption classes. Slightly dated, but it's still true that British society, and to a certain extent American society, is divided into three consumption classes. One is the lower, we can't call them classes now because they aren't really, but the lowest consumption status area of people who spend a high proportion of their income on basics, on food and clothing and shelter of a basic kind. In the middle, according to Douglas, is a consumption class of people for whom status competition through the acquisition of relatively expensive consumer durables is a major preoccupation. As I was walking to the bus this morning in my Fen village, I was amazed. There were people who I knew were not particularly well. I looked in their front drives. There were four very expensive cars. Four Jaguar-type cars published parked in the front porches of these, or at least in the front drives of these places, really displaying and elaborating their status through consumer goods like that. Then if you move to our house, we have now quite a battered old Volkswagen, because as there you point out, the highest status, I hate to say I'm in the highest status, but in the status beyond buying lots of cars, comprises people for whom time and information are the most precious commodities. I don't want to have four cars going and spend all my time getting them repaired and serviced and MOT'd and so on. I value the time I can spend reading and meeting friends and doing those kinds of consumption. Because the last point I want to make is that when we talk about consumption, anthropologists aren't just talking about what you put into your mouth or what you put on your back. You're consuming me, I'm consuming you, without making it sound too cannibalistic. We consume all sorts of invisible things, and most of our pleasure comes from the consumption of invisible things and immaterial things. And you, as aspiring upper middle class people at Cambridge University, will value those sorts of things. I don't know whether this is true of student culture, but probably people won't judge you now so much by what you have and what you display in terms of clothes and ornaments and so on, but whether you're an interesting person and whether they want to spend time with you and whether you share various cultural resources. And that's very characteristic of this third strata that Douglas talks about. Now I want to turn about to the question of the globalization of culture, cultural consumption. There's been quite a lot of work now about the spread of this. You might call it Coca-Colaization or the spread of cultural values and so on. But one particular aspect of it which interests me and I want to talk about briefly is the way in which consumption and what we consume changes political, social, and cultural life. You may think of things like tea, which I'm going to talk about, as just objects which we consume, but they actually change the whole geopolitical nature of our world, as well as many other things. One famous book on this, which some of you might know of and be interested in, is Sidney Mintz's book, his name is near the bottom, on Sweetness and Power, which is a study of sugar and the way in which sugar affected colonialism in the Caribbean. He shows, I'm quoting from Han, how the demand for sugar in European societies was influenced by the new industrial systems of production in Europe. Meeting the demand had far-reaching consequences for production systems in the Caribbean and also in Africa, where most of the slave labour for the sugar plantations was recruited. Sugar, slavery, the relations of empire, And even little things like taste. I think I'll cut this out of Letters to Lily, but there was a book on British tastes, and it struck me as very interesting that if you look at the pattern of the tastes of Britain, you'll find it reflects the sugar trades. Bristol, which is the great sugar importing slave port, is famous for its sherry, made from sweet sugar, or sweetened with sugar. Further north, if any of you have climbed in the Lake District, you'll know the famous Kendal mint cake, and that comes from the sugar ports of Lancashire. Or if you go further north to Scotland, you find the places awash with Macfarlane Lang biscuits and other sugar-based biscuit-type and things. And that's because the western side of this country had the sugar ports. And in fact, Adam Smith would never have been famous or even existed without the sugar trade of Glasgow, on which the wealth of Scotland was largely based, and the slave trades there. So sugar has changed our world in all sorts of consumption of sugar. But I want to give you one other example very briefly, and that is tea. I'm the son of a tea planter, and this may have affected my interest in the subject. I don't know whether I got interested. But I wrote a book with my mother on Green Girl, the Empire of Tea. And the theme of the book, as I came to write it, was the extraordinary enormous effect that tea has had on us. Before I wrote it, I thought tea was just something you drank. I drank a certain amount of, and I knew very little about what effect it had on the world or what it was actually in the tea. So, very, very briefly, tea was invented or discovered 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 years ago, probably by monkeys who started rubbing it on each other when they were sick. They discovered that if you chew it and rub it on a wound, it helps you. And also they found that monkeys found that chewing it made them feel really good. They hopped around better than the little monkeys do. So the local natives just watched the monkeys and then they started chewing and drinking it, and they felt better too. Then the Chinese, or they started trading with the locals, and they found this leaf. This is about now 4,000, 5,000 years ago. And this leaf spread from southern China. And about 500 AD, about 1,500 years ago, it began to spread all over China, and it began to be exported to Tibet, Mongolia in about the 8th, 9th centuries. And all by the time of the 8th, 9th century in China, it was universal in much of China. It had spread out from the monastic gardens where it was first cultivated as a herbal plant and was now being drunk by very large numbers of the Chinese. It then spread to Japan in the 12th, 13th centuries, taken by a monk there. And so half of the world, the half of the world in the East, Eastern Asia, by the 14th, 15th century was drinking tea on a large scale. It then was discovered by the Europeans who went to Japan, China in the 17th century, and they started to bring it back. And as a medicine, really, to begin with, because it was known to have wonderful medical properties like ginseng. Then in the early 18th century, they opened up the direct tea pepper trade around the Cape of Good Hope to China, and tea suddenly dropped in price, and everyone in Britain started to drink it. When I say everyone, very, very large numbers of people from about the middle of the 18th century. And then it was very fashionable in America until it was used as a reason for the wars of the War of Independence with the Boston Tea Party. And it became the favourite drink of the White Empire, Canada and Australia. Then the British, who had founded their wealth, the British Empire was founded on tea. The takeover of India was largely on the basis of the wealth that was being made by the East India Company from the export trade from China. They were paying for the empire with tea. It led to the Opium Wars and the destabilization of China because the British had to, they couldn't pay for their tea, so they had to export something to the Chinese, so they forced them to take opium. So the downfall of China in the 19th century is a side consequence. The takeover of India is a side consequence. But tea also has extraordinary other effects, which are all detailed in the book, really. It affects our culture, it affects social relations, for instance. Women's status in the 18th century was changed by the fact that they now had a meal over which they presided. It was middle-class women who were in charge of tea. It altered domestic relations because children were now brought into this meal and the children would sit round with their father and their mother. So domesticity in the 18th century. The timing of meals, suddenly you had tea time, so you pushed supper later. It affected aesthetics and art. Wedgwood and all the pottery industry was altered by this. And of course it had done this on a much larger scale in Japan and China. The tea ceremony in Japan is the central iconic and cultural feature of Japan, and it affected Buddhism in China and in Japan. So it spread out into politics, religion, and everything else. That's enough on tea, because if you're interested in that, either you can have a look at the book or I'll point you to some materials on the website in a minute where I talk about this further. But I never realised, and the last thing perhaps, just to show I'm completely crazy, was that tea contains 500 chemicals. We only know what effects a few have at the moment. It certainly contains polyphenols, and these tea polyphenols and other substances are very, very strong antibacterials. In other words, a dangerous bacteria, just to give you the famous experiment which I cite in the book, an American surgeon, when they first discovered, through another chain which I'll talk about in a minute, they discovered the existence of bacteria. Within a year or two he did a test where he took a glass of water and a glass of cold tea, and he put the three most dangerous waterborne bacteria for typhoid, cholera and dysentery into glasses. In the water they bred and were highly toxic after 24 hours. In the cold tea they were all killed. If everyone on earth drank tea seriously, it would cut out, I think, a lot of the waterborne disease, which is the main crippler in the world today, even more than AIDS and malaria. I'll talk about this in some other lectures I'll be giving on a little bit on strategies of survival, those of you who are doing the social anthropology part. But it's not just that. A lot of modern diseases, I mean, it's all on my website or on the book. Various cancers, forms of cancer, heart attacks, strokes, muscular problems, tooth decays, influenza, and even the stone. And the last thing is that it helps your concentration. They've done tests on tea. If you drink tea, this isn't a banned substance, but don't sue me. If you drink tea before an examination or anything else like that, it increases your concentration, your memory and everything, they reckon by about 15%, which could make the difference for a class. So keep drinking tea. But make sure, do some tests before. You might be allergic. There are a few people who are allergic to tea. I don't want you coming and telling me you failed your tri course because you're taking my instructions. This is partly why I drink it here and before occasions. It really does help. Has some effect on the brain, which improves coordination and memory. You may think it's having a terrible effect on me, but there we are. Okay, technology and how it helps. Technology, we're surrounded by technology, obviously, like consumerism. What is technology? Well, the best definition is that it's an extension of man. Human beings are born naked, without fur, etc. They're pretty useless creatures, and yet they have extended their arms, their backs, their brains through various technologies. So in the famous books, it's always suggested that technology is really an extension of various body parts of the human being, and it alters our whole world. And the reason it does this is because of a simple device which I had explained to me with a co-author of another book I wrote, Jerry Martin, who died a couple of years ago about this time, was a scientist and multimillionaire who set up controlled engineering firms all over the world, and he discovered the secret of really how technologies change our world through a very, very simple idea, which is what he calls the technological triangle. This is described in a book we wrote together on glass. Basically, you start with the top of a triangle. You start with ideas, pure research. Someone in Cambridge wandering around King's College and Full School Lane comes up with the secret of life, walks into the eagle and pronounces, "I have discovered the secret of life," crick, i.e. DNA. It's a pure discovery. Then that becomes embedded in technologies, in medicines, in all sorts of other sorts of things, mobile phones and other things which I hope are going to be turned off shortly. And this, you have one or two of these things, you have a few medicines, you have a few mobile phones, or whatever the technology which has come out of the pure invention. Then this is multiplied by the market. You get thousands and millions of these things. At that point, it changes the whole world, because it then goes back, the technology's part of it goes back and enables people to find out new things. So you go around this triangle, and as Jerry put it, the faster you go around this triangle, the faster you get technological development. And if you go around this triangle a number of times, you will change your world. There are other effects which in technology which we talked about. One is what's known, he called the Meccano effect of technology, which is that do any of you know this game, this children's building thing called Meccano? You mostly have heard of it, though whether you've done it, I don't know. But in Meccano, you buy a simple set and you can do various things, and then you buy, your parents hopefully buy you the upgrade. And you suddenly discover that this has got some new things in it, like wheels or some angle that you didn't have before. And it has an explosive effect. It doesn't just mean that you can do a few more things additively. It's like geometric progression in population. You can do thousands of new things because just this wheel or this connecting thing, it multiplies the effects of all the previous ones. And technology has this effect. It allows technological growth to be exponential, non-linear, to go up like this if it's followed through. And you can see this in many technologies. You can see it in printing, in clocks, in glass, photography, and in computing. And the example I'll give you just for a couple of minutes is in one which we pursued in glass. Glass originally was made, we wrote a book called The Glass Bathyscape, and I'll show you a little bit in a moment. Glass was invented basically as something beautiful, as an alternative to jewels and so on. And then the Romans made a big thing of it in relation to domestic ware. They had showers made of glass, and then the walls were of glass. Their streets sometimes had drain pipes with glass and so on and so on. They were the great glass makers, but they used it for practical things. It was really only starting with the Arabic and Islamic civilizations, Al-Hazan and others in the 9th, 8th, 9th century, who began to see that glass could help you to think better. It's the one technology, it's the most powerful thinking technology. Tea helps your body, glass helps your mind. And so from about the 13th century, you get the beginnings of what we roughly call the scientific revolution and the Renaissance, taking from Arabic science, the idea that glass, because it changes, alters light, it has various properties which makes it absolutely different from everything else. It alters light so that to take a lens like this, with this lens, as Roger Bacon in the 13th century pointed out, you can see long distances. You change your eyes, you can now, he was already foreshadowing a telescope and a microscope. With two lenses, he said, you could see a great distance. It wasn't actually invented, a telescope properly, until the beginning of the 17th century. But human beings can now use a bit of glass to see further than they've ever seen. And to see tiny things, which is a point that he also made, through the microscope. So it alters what we can see of the world, and since human beings get 70% of their information about the world through their eyes, it really changes what we perceive about the world. And it began, above all, to give confidence to scientists, because suddenly we could see things that the classics, the great civilizations of the past, had never seen. Aristotle and co. had never seen what a tiny thing, as in Leeuwenhoek's famous encyclopedia, what a piece of cork really looks like, what a flea, the hairs on a flea's leg. So that was one feature of glass. The other is that it's inert and you can see through it. Do any of you know what this is? It's a small model. Any guesses? Okay, well, this is a small model of the thing that made our world in many ways. It's a model of Pasteur's device for confirming that there are bacteria. So the discovery of bacteria came through this glass device. What he did was that he put some stuff inside, some soup or broth, and then he left it open like that, and the air went in and the broth decayed. He then put a cork on the top, because the idea was that these things were coming in and getting. He put a cork on the top, and he found that it still decayed, but there was something inside it. And then, using the microscopes, which were just getting powerful enough, he looked and he saw the bacteria. So the whole of modern medicine, Koch and Pasteur, comes out of glass devices. And if you just unthink the 17th century revolution, what could you have done without microscopes, telescopes? Where would Galileo have been? Where would Copernicus have been? Where would all the other scientists, for instance, Robert Boyle, his discovery of the vacuum was only made possible by a glass, large glass receptacle. And without the glass, the discovery of the vacuum, you couldn't have had the 18th century discovery of the efficient steam engine. Without that, you couldn't have had the Industrial Revolution. So you get these triangles going round. So reliable information coming out of technologies feeds back, and this is why our world spirals on. We live in a very paradoxical world, as I've implied, because we have so much around us. Our world is awash with material affluence, in the West anyway, and increasingly in some other parts of the world. And yet, we still seem unsatisfied and anxious and confused. It's partly, I think, that our society has no infrastructure at all. Marx thought that economic life was the infrastructure, but it really is only partially, as I've implied. There are many things that money aren't involved with. We can't really be certain what the final bedrock of our society is like. Money and markets are terribly important, but they don't provide everything, and the resurgence of religious enthusiasms and so on show that we're not satisfied with just consuming it. Pursuing monetary goals. Probably the greatest insight into this whole world is in Max Weber's work, and some of you may be familiar with his famous Protestant ethic thesis, where he shows how Protestantism, I mean, there are many people who don't agree with the exact story, but that something in the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries created an unbounded, open and restless, anxious, never to be satisfied world. At the heart of it, of course, is the famous paradox, the Max Weber paradox, which is that Calvinism was meant to cure this. It was meant to tell you that the moment you were born, you were either damned or saved. There was nothing you could do. It abolished the Catholic idea of grace, that you could work and for your salvation and burn candles and so on. You were absolutely damned or saved before you were a day old. So you should just relax and say, okay, well, if I'm damned, that's that. In fact, curiously, it had the exact opposite effect, because you didn't want to go to hell fire and so on. So you spent the whole life trying to prove to yourself and to other people that you were saved by doing good works. and above all by saving and being orderly and rational and careful and bureaucratic and all the things that Max Weber talks about. And this was one of the reasons why the world became wealthy, because for the first time you have had a civilization which basically didn't live beyond its means. There's a famous book by Simon Chama, S-C-H-A-M-A. The title sort of captures it, The Embarrassment of Riches. It's about Holland and how the Dutch, being very abstemious, but wearing black and white, keeping their houses quite free of junk, they became extremely rich. It's a problem that faces all rational, careful, orderly, saving civilizations. It faces religious orders. It leaves the corruption of religions because they become very rich, like the Benedictines or like some of the Buddhist monasteries. You don't spend, you live simply, but people keep giving you money and it accumulates. So our life is based on various paradoxes, and above all the paradox that much of our lives, although supposedly lived in a market society, is outside the market. Love, friendship, family, sport, leisure, gardening. Nearly 90% of our imaginative and other lives is actually nothing to do with the crude, crass pursuit of profit. And the other paradox, which is that unless we understand the way in which we're being constantly encouraged to live beyond our means, we will end up with frustration. So more tea and more Zen, and you'll all be fine.